Welcome to the OMC P-Core Research Data Use Scenarios Board Group Meeting Number 11. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself over the phone stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Priscilla Tula.
Thank you. So good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to folks on the East Coast, on the West Coast. So this is actually our 11th meeting, and we have one more after this, and I know we've, you know, sort of made lots of progress in terms of discussing different research data use scenarios, and then most recently we've also been sharing with you some of the use case analysis that we've been doing. Okay, joining me on the call from the NORC team, we have Lauren Havi, Eric Oppelroot, Gagan Jindal, and Catherine Donaldson. We also have our colleagues from GW, Jane Thorpe, Lara Cartwright-Smith, and Elizabeth Gray. And our other team members include Joanna Singaru and Daniela Mika. Joining us from ONC, we have Devi Mehta and Helen. Okay, so I see a number of you joining via the WebEx, and you know we're just about to get started. So I guess very briefly, in terms of the agenda for today, we are going to be talking about a scenario that we have developed around the mosaic effect. So Daniela will walk you through that. And then we also wanted to share with you some related use case analysis that we've been doing, okay? So we'll be talking through two use cases, very briefly through use case one, because it sort of tees up some of the discussion that will take place under use case four, okay? And then if time permits, we actually have another scenario on combining claims data and birth records for PCOR, but we'll see if we have time to share that with you. If we don't share that with you this today, we'll certainly do that at the next call. Okay? Next slide, please. So I think at this time I'm going to hand it over to Daniela, and if we can bring up the scenario on the mosaic effect, that will be great. Okay, Daniela, I'm handing it over to you.
Okay, great. So this scenario is something that has come up inside conversations when we've been talking about other data combination cases, but we wanted to spend some time today discussing what kinds of re-identification risks are coming up in
is anyone else not seeing anything? I'm not seeing anything on my screen. This is Lucy.
Lucy, you should have the WebEx in the screen available. Is anyone
I do, but it's not, there's nothing up. It says there's nothing up. Am I the only one?
Yeah, this is Helen. I can see the screen. I'm not sure what the problem is.
Yeah, so can I.
Okay. Okay, I have a problem.
Okay, no problem. Lucy, we will send you the scenarios in email. So you can follow.
I think I already have them. Catherine sent them last night, so I'll
okay.
Just go to that. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Go ahead, Daniela.
Okay, I'll try to talk through it in a way that makes it clear that you don't necessarily need to have it in front of you. Sorry about that. So the mosaic effect is sort of something that has come up, like I mentioned, in other use cases and other scenarios that we've spoken about. But I wanted to talk about it explicitly with you guys a little bit today and get your feedback on it and some of the sort of surrounding issues that might be coming about with the way that different kinds of organizations might be behaving. So The scenario is related to a longitudinal data set that is available for public use with appropriate agreements. And there's a researcher that might be interested in combining this data set with other data sets in order to continue to do research. And lately we've seen a number of publications where researchers in cryptography have demonstrated that even de-identified data sets are not necessarily not necessarily privacy-preserving, and that when combined with other data sets like voter records, individuals can be re-identified. And so this scenario contemplates that kind of case, as well as what might be done by the different parties involved in this. So we're imagining here what a researcher would do after a re-identification risk has been identified and the identity of a patient in a database has been discovered by another researcher that's interested in demonstrating ways that privacy should be a concern for these kinds of public use data sets. And what should the different parties in this do, and how are people dealing with this now is something that we'd like to hear from you guys. So I have a few questions down here. If you can scroll up a little bit, please. Thank you. So one of the issues that's correspondent to this is mandates from NIH to share data if you have NIH funding and you're collecting data that may include some private information even under consent. How does that relate to this case where it's known that, you know, due to the mosaic effect, someone's privacy may be at risk if a public use data set can be linked with other data sets? And then in this case, what obligations? I named Harvey here, but this is Harvey Hacker, the cryptographer that was able to crack identities in this public use data set using a combination of other data sets. What are the ethical obligations that this cryptographer has to protect the algorithms or publish the algorithms that might be being used? And what obligations does he have to communicate the privacy risks to different parties? And you talked a little bit about this before, but there's some questions also about the, you know, what scientific journals to do when a discovery like this is submitted, and what are their obligations to share the information with the data holders and the data stewards for the public use data sets. And then some questions about how you might notify the research participants in such a study if their identities were at risk, or there was an increased risk for their identity being compromised based on these kinds of studies. And question is what kind of guidelines are in place right now to assess these trade-offs between privacy risks and the utility of data sets. So I think that any of you that have had an opportunity to think about those guidelines would be really interested in hearing how people are evaluating that. And then some questions that have come up also around what we're expecting with PMI is whether researchers should have a special status or special trust that would distinguish them from citizen scientists or members of the public. And what kind of opportunities there may be to protect privacy while still allowing citizen scientists to work on data sets like these. And how can the risks of re-identification be balanced and against the health insight as well? And finally, sort of looking at the risks of re-identification against the burden of maintaining data in secure enclaves, and how that might impact the ways that data may or may not be accessible. So I think this is, you know, the table sort of has the key elements. I won't read through them here. It's mostly to hear what kind of experience you guys have with the mosaic effect and getting a better understanding of the perceptions of IRBs and people that are trying to adhere to both NIH policy and privacy protection. Let me open up to you guys and to hear more.
Thanks, Daniela.
So this is Leslie Francis. I do have one suggestion, which would be an additional question. What kinds of follow-up should there be in terms of identifying either researchers or citizen scientists who are using the data, having data use agreements with them, and or following up to make sure that the agreements are kept?
Right, so some system for maintaining the data use agreements and tracking them as metadata that's going along with each distribution or access to the data set.
Metadata is a great way to work on it, but also just any kind of ongoing follow-up and is the idea of a data use agreement, which is essentially a contract, the right way to try to do that?
Hi, this is John Wilbanks from SageBio Networks. We do precisely this with our stuff. So we've started sharing the first of our clinical studies that we did last year using iPhones. And what we do is we publish the name and the validated identity of the researcher and their data use statement in a way that the participants, any participant or public member of the public, can see what people said their data use statement was. And then we have sort of a set of feedback loops that lets the public ask the researcher for progress reports. And then we require an annual update of progress that we can feedback to the participants and show to the public. Now, we've not gotten far enough in to know how well it works over time, but it's something that if people want to look at, you know, everything is public. We've had about 45 approved projects in 6 weeks from about 12 countries. So it's working well from the getting the data out perspective and getting the data use statement fed back. But we don't know what it's going to look like from an enforcement or a violations perspective yet.
It would be wonderful to know more about that if you could share it. This is Leslie.
I'd be happy to. Would you like me to send some documents to the core staff and then they syndicate?
Yeah, John, this is Priscilla. If you can do that, and then we can make sure we'll share it with this group, okay?
Okay.
Great, thank you. So I know Bob Galman also has some questions or comments. Bob, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. I think that scenario raises the question of whether there should be any public data at all. Now, I don't mean that quite so broadly as I suggested, but any kind of data, certainly individual-level data, and certainly maybe some other kinds of data, I don't know where to draw the lines yet, can be made available to anybody, but the data use agreement notion is very important. And I've proposed in a law journal article, which I think I sent you guys, a piece of legislation that would make data use agreements more enforceable and provide incentives for people on both ends to use the structure. And there are a whole variety of enforcement methods that can be used, and you can still make data available to anybody. You just have chain of custody for where the data goes and who's obliged to do what with it. And I don't think that given the power of technology today to re-identify stuff, that basically there ought to be any individual level public data that doesn't have contractual controls on it.
Yeah, and we, you know, we listened to Bob a lot when we did that. So we don't even call our data public data. We call it data that's available inside a trust. And we contractually block redistribution, re-identification, and use of the data for marketing purposes. And then we have a fair amount of transaction costs that the data user has to go through, including identity validation, passing an ethics test, swearing an oath. But sort of once they're in, they're in. So it was actually inspired by global entry in the sense that we wanted trusted data user programs as opposed to public data. That we felt was the best balance.
So can I ask, I'm not sure who that was who was just speaking, but once somebody is in and can, I guess, share your data, how do you protect the data in transmission?
So we don't. This is data that we consented explicitly that for this kind of use. So it's an opt-in program in our studies where participants can donate their data to qualified researchers worldwide. So we actually do not apply extensive technical protection measures to the data sets. We use contracts to prevent redistribution, but we actually rely on the researcher verification process, creating enough roadblocks to join and liability chains in terms of violation to serve as that protection. We explicitly consent people that there's a risk of privacy breach, and if they don't want that, then they should either not be in the study, or if in the study, they should not choose to share their data broadly.
Well, in order to encourage participation at both ends, have you ever considered stronger protections?
We have very strong encryption on the study technologies as things go to and from the phone. But, you know, once people start to share, you know, we could encrypt this stuff in transit. We could encrypt it at rest. But the point is that people are going to be downloading copies of the data that they can use. That's the point of this, is to be able to take the data from one study and combine it with data from another study. We don't encode complex data use restrictions upstream, because the research we've done with our enrolled participants indicates that people really want their data to get used and are comfortable with certain amounts of risk in that. But we're outliers, and that's why I don't want to overstate whether or not what we're doing is relevant for all kinds of data. We don't bring in EHR or genotype data, for example. We mainly use sensors and surveys from the phone.
That's an important data point. Thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions or comments?
I have a follow-on comment for that, and this is sort of maybe foreshadowing some of the scenarios we'll be working on in the future. But have you guys made any effort to measure sort of cumulative risks to the privacy when you have either multiple access to the records or multiple possibilities to combine your data sets with other data sets to try to quantify what that risk might be and communicate that with your participants?
So now you're asking John that question? I'm just curious, who are you posing the question to? Is that more...
For you, John, because it sounds like you have a very sophisticated approach to this, but if anyone else has any ideas, that would be good to hear as well.
So I didn't quite understand the question. I apologize. Can you rephrase it?
So some of the things that have come about recently is this ability to measure privacy risk using different kinds of tools to look at how likely it is that someone could be re-identified with other data sets. And that measurement is something that we've sort of become interested in working through the scenario and others. And
okay.
Whether or not that should be something communicated back to participants.
That makes more sense. I apologize for not catching it the first time through. Now it makes sense. We have not tried to do that. So much of what we're doing is bootstrapped that it's sort of hard for us to do a lot of the interesting governance analytics. We did just finish a retrospective analysis of about 8,000 comments from this first study that we're sharing. We've got this running in actually 8 studies simultaneously, but we've only rolling this out in one because the data are really low risk. It's, you know, gyroscope and accelerometer and touchscreen, all of this stuff when it's triggered in very specific moments, not sort of passively ambiently recording. And so we after consultation with a lot of folks, we said this was really low risk data generally, and we felt that allowed us to sort of go forward with these more experimental methodologies. But we have not done, and I would be happy to make the data available to privacy researchers who would like to use it for this purpose. It's available for any research purpose, including that. But we don't have that kind of expertise on staff, so we haven't done that. We are very interested in trying to understand whether or not we could accurately predict a priori the privacy risk for one individual versus another. But the danger of type 1 and type 2 errors is such that we have sort of said we would rather be conservative in the way we consent everybody rather than make one of those errors of inclusion or exclusion at this point. But anyone that wants to do privacy research on our data, that's an allowed use. As long as there's not direct re-identification going on, that's something we've excluded. We'd be welcome to analyze the data and to look at it from across different studies and that sort of thing.
Can I add another question, Daniela? So one thought we had was that maybe research information systems could actually quantify the risk of re-identification as you add a richer data set to your research data use. Has anyone done any work to evaluate how the risk increases as you get more and more data about any research participant?
So I don't know if anyone on this call has, but I do know that there have been studies along these lines that with respect to particular kinds of data sets that are widely used, like voter records.
Okay. So we just don't have anyone on the line who might have done this.
Oh, this is Bob Dillman. I don't have an answer to that, but I just want to point out that there is so much data about people available in private hands, enormous volumes of data, that if you're just looking at data within a research project or comparing across two research projects or something, you're only looking at a drop in the bucket. So that's something to be concerned about. If you have a narrow focus and you calculate a privacy risk, you may be wildly underestimating what the real risk is.
Right. I mean, there's sort of a sub story within this scenario about, you know, what a researcher might do after being faced with this case a number of times, and whether they might, if they're really interested in data science, whether they might be better positioned to be in private sector work doing the kind of analysis that you're alluding to. I didn't want to muddy the water too much with that, but I think there are workforce implications for these kinds of restrictions as well.
So any other questions or comments from anyone regarding this? This is actually quite a helpful discussion, and John, I'd be curious to, I mean, it'd be good for us to sort of look at some of the work that you're doing, because I think it has sort of direct bearing on this particular scenario and some of the questions that we've posed. So then I'm going to move us along, and so I think at this point we want to sort of move into the use case analysis, and Yuan, I'm wondering whether we should do the one related to the mosaic effect first and then come back to use case one, okay? Does that sound
sure?
Yeah. So if we can just move along to the use case four analysis, identification, re-identification of PCOR data. So just to sort of very briefly refresh everyone, you know, we've been taking all these scenarios and characterize or clustering them under broader use cases, as they've sort of identified common, you know, requirements around them. We've just talked about sort of the mosaic effect, and under this particular use case, we're looking at both the identification and re-identification of PCOR data. Okay, next slide, please. So, Yuan, let me ask you to sort of maybe walk our stakeholders through some of this. But before we do that, Daniela, did you want to bring up some of the legal discussion that we've been having internally? We can move to that slide so you can sort of just tee up some of the things that we sort of understand to be the case, and then we can go through the use case analysis. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, Priscilla. I think some of the people on the call know that this issue is really near and dear to my heart, and we have spent a lot of time in our research network trying to navigate the space around how you can securely link records from multiple sources while protecting privacy. And the legal team here have been really, really helpful in getting some clarification on issues. And I wanted to share what we've discussed about this, and also I'm eagerly awaiting what your comments are on how we can manage this. So one of the prerequisites for being able to merge data sets, whether we're thinking about something along the lines of the mosaic effect or other discussions that we've had earlier with data that hasn't been consented, is the way that different covered entities and other individuals that might hold some liability would be treated with different kinds of data processing for HIPAA. So the de-identification under safe harbor doesn't allow us easily to link records from multiple sources unless they're in part capturing the same information. So there are some edge cases where it may be true that we can use safe harbor de-identification to link records, but in most cases we're turning more towards using the expert determination method in order to apply approaches that would create some kind of coded record that could be linked from multiple parties. And that solution has been discussed at length. It's been applied in PCORnet in one of the research networks and published, but getting a better understanding about what kinds of agreements are possible and whether or not these things have indemnification implications or if they require agreements that would mutually hold people accountable for what they're doing with the records is an important thing for us to discuss. And we also spent a significant amount of time discussing this in another meeting with AHIP. So, I'll probably pass this off to also Jane and others in order to clarify all of this. But if we have a hashed approach for record linkage, we don't necessarily require a waiver of authorization or a BAA if we can get that expert determination. But the expert determination has to be based on the re-identification risk for the combined data, not the data that is transferred from each site locally. So that was an important thing when we're thinking about how we might implement these kinds of record linkages. And any subsequent re-identification step would require a HIPAA waiver or consent. So when we're thinking about the workflows and the use cases, these are alternative paths to what we're talking about today that still have some approach that can be used when we're trying to securely link records in a privacy-preserving way in order to get the richness of data that might come from linking across multiple sources. But this was very helpful for me to get oriented. But I think maybe others might have some clarification on these kinds of issues as well. So I will let them weigh in now.
Thanks, Daniela. Chief, did you want to add anything, to this? I know we talked about it at length yesterday. Was there any sort of finer point you wanted to make on this? And then I would open it up to the stakeholders to see if anyone, you know, I know we have some individuals on the call that are sort of very close to some of this, if they have any comments to this, okay?
Thanks, Michelle. This is Jane. I think Danielle has covered it very nicely, and I'd rather use this time to hear from the stakeholders on the call. So maybe if we move into that directly, and if there are questions or issues, obviously we're happy to jump in.
This is Bob Gelman. I've got a question on the last line on the slide where it says, any subsequent re-identification requires a HIPAA waiver or consent. Re-identification by who?
In this case, we were referring to by the researchers or the people that are acting on behalf of researchers for research uses of data.
Well, you know, once data falls outside the HIPAA threshold, it's not regulated by HIPAA anymore, period. You can do anything you want with the data. You can publish it in a paper, you can put it on the internet, you can do anything with it. There are no downstream controls that apply to it.
Who makes the expert determination in the first place? Who is that referring to?
This would be a qualified statistician, right? I think I'm going to step back and let the legal people describe these because I'm not the legal expert, but in this case we're thinking about the qualified statistician that has that expertise.
So this is Leslie Francis. Bob is entirely correct, and it's just a huge gap in HIPAA.
Mm-hmm. Danielle, I think what you were describing when we had talked about this earlier was the concept, however, after when the researcher comes back to the covered entity from whom they originally received the de-identified information, either through safe harbor standards or expert determination, if the researcher comes back to the covered entity and is requesting additional information, and it's the role of the covered entity at that point, that I would particularly be interested in hearing any input from the stakeholders, you know, sort of the process at that point, once the covered entity has had that request from the researcher who has the de-identified information, so we understand that, you know, HIPAA stops for those purposes, but if the researcher then comes back to the covered entity, the original source, and asks for additional information or has a request that would require the covered entity to link or identify the information to provide additional information, in that scenario, I think that's what, Daniela, you were thinking about by re-identification, is when the researcher would go back to the original source, the covered entity, and ask for an additional data set that would require the covered entity to to link, re-identify that information in order to fulfill that request, which again may be de-identified information for the second request, but it has that process of the covered entity in the middle where they actually have to relink the information in order to pull additional elements to supply to the researcher. Danielle, is that what you were considering?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Sorry, I didn't make that clear when I was talking through this.
So are you saying that it would be the CE that would make that expert determination when the researcher comes back?
Danielle, I think that's how you explained it to us.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that this is the CE, the first time and the second time. I don't know legally who is responsible for identifying the expert and qualifying their credentials. But we recognize from this conversation that the CE would obviously need to verify that determination was fulfilling their obligation.
And Danielle, this is Laura. It would be whoever is de-identifying the information, which in this case would be the CE, because what they're releasing is de-identified, and so they're the ones that have the obligation to make sure that it truly is de-identified using the expert.
Okay, thanks, Laura. Any other sort of questions or comments?
I think that should be made clear. The concept of expert determination, initial caps, implies a large balloon about who is doing this and what they're doing. And in whatever final form this takes, I think that merits a huge asterisk and an explanation of what's going on here. And I guess as a potential study participant, I would certainly have to hope that the CE knows what they're doing, that we're talking about potentially large academic medical centers that deal with issues like this all the time, and not a set of rural community hospitals in Wyoming who wouldn't have the capability to make an expert determination about something like this. So I think all that needs to be discussed. If you're talking about the CE making the expert determination, it needs to be stated that capability to do that varies right now from non-existent to probably okay, and somebody would have to keep track of this, potentially monitor it, potentially provide technical assist, you know, all that stuff. I think that's a huge asterisk here that needs to be included.
This is Marisa in OCR. I just wanted to note that the privacy rules, the identification provisions specify, what the expertise needs to be, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a workforce member of the covered entity itself that does it. They can hire a business associate to do the de-identification of the data for them. So that's, a circumstance in which they might contract with an appropriate statistician who can do the de-identification for them. But ultimately, we were talking about, the ultimate responsibility, the liability would rest with the covered entity for ensuring that, before it makes the ultimate disclosure of de-identified data, that it is actually de-identified within the scope of the rules.
And just to clarify, I think the assumption throughout is that any subsequent request from the researcher to the covered entity will not require identifiable information in this particular scenario. It will be a request that refers to the hash value identifier of that, related to that research participant. It is not in any way requiring the covered entity to do any special re-identification. They already have the identity of that patient, and they already know what their equivalent hash identifier is. So the covered entity has that information. They don't have to do any special magic to provide additional information if they choose to do so. So just want to be clear here, because I think it's implying some
some additional re-identification that I don't think it's necessarily technically required in order to fulfill such a request.
So this is Kevin Haynes.
Go ahead, Kevin. Yeah,
And really follows on to that last point. So let's say I'm a covered entity, a large insurer that has tens of millions of lives. Obviously, we could go through a de-identification process and do an anonymous hash. And Kevin Haynes, 89, I won't finish that sentence, mail would get turned into this junk. Now, I can't unlearn that knowledge, right? I know that Kevin Haynes is now this junk. If Kevin Haynes is also in Daniela Meeker's UC system because he had a heart attack last week, at the UC system, right? Hopefully, UC also figured out that I'm Kevin Haynes, 89, male, and was able to de-identify my data into the same junk. Now, UC can't unlearn that knowledge that Kevin Haynes mapped to this junk. Now, the junk hash is able to be, you know, transmitted across, and I go, oh, great, Kevin Haynes has this longitudinal data and has that ton of data that the UC system doesn't even have a clue about, right? My urgent care visit at CVS Minute Clinic last week, all these other little things, right? And vice versa, the health plan researchers at a covered entity don't have the knowledge of vancomycin 1 gram Q1215 south. So my question is, the whole concept of re-identification, I already know the identity of this. I have to trust through a statistical matching algorithm that that hash is Kevin Haynes on both sides of that aisle. But once that linkage is done, then I know it's Kevin Haynes and Daniela knows it's Kevin Haynes.
You're correct, but I wouldn't know that. If I received that hash value as a third-party researcher from two data sites, I would simply know Kevin by their hash identifier. I wouldn't know who they really were in the real world. I just know they're individual ones.
You're implying then is that all researchers in the United States of America will not be affiliated with a covered entity, right? I'm a researcher affiliated with a covered entity that has knowledge. Daniela is a researcher at a covered entity that has knowledge. It's going to take trust, years of trust, really, to get to the point where Danielle and I's organizations can start sharing data covered entity to covered entity. Then it's going to take additional time to get to the point of, and maybe it's a lower wall, but saying, oh, all these people who I don't even know are getting this anonymous linkage data. At least I have a relationship with the patient and want to protect the patient's privacy, as does Daniela and her organization. I want to get there first before then we go to this total third-party person who comes in off the street and says, hi, I'm a researcher and I need data. Does that make sense?
Well, I'll defer to the jurist on this matter, but I would say the individual that already has a relationship with that patient, already, as you said, already they cannot unknow them. So they know them already. I think the individuals that not have a relationship with this patient should not be able to glean their identity from these identifiers. That's, I think, the technical objective of creating the hash value, is not to not be able to say that 123 is Kevin, but rather to just know that 123 appears in two sites, and I am able to link those medical records from those two sites, and I can do research without necessarily having to know the identity of that participant.
Now, in the security world, what we would do is we would use a salt value to ensure that, you know, the same data being hashed by two separate organizations produces distinct and unique hashes because they're not using the same salt value for that that individual or that record.
In that case, then there would be no chance of correlating identities across sites, and that is basically the question. Is, and maybe we can go to the workflow analysis. Is it if your objective is to correlate the identity of a research participant across data sites, what is the best way of establishing a multi-site research identifier that leads to meaningful research results? Clearly, I mean, Danielle discussed safe harbor. So if you strip the data of any identifying traits, you have perfectly private data. You just don't have meaningful research results in that case because you have no idea that the same patient may have received the same treatment in five different sites, which may tell you something useful in your research. So the objective of this use case is to establish a research identifier that matches one patient across multiple sites. And if that's the objective, then, you know, clearly in some sites, then you might be able to correlate the data. But again, let's talk about what happens is that the information from all the sites would be aggregated by a researcher. So rather than each site looking at every other site's data, the purpose of the research that I use scenario is to aggregate data from multiple sites, correlate the identities of the patients through some mechanism that we will discuss, and establish the same patient may have been seen and received specific treatment at different sites. So that's sort of the objective of this multi-site identifier. If it was sufficient to strip all the data of any identity, then this use case wouldn't be required. So we do have an assumption here that there is a waiver of authorization that may in some cases allow the data site to share some patient identifying traits and maybe something as small as a hash value corresponding to their identity, or it may be identifying traits that are therefore used by the Enterprise Master Patient Index, this identity cross-referencing system, to establish an internal identity across sites for all these records. So while each site will know the patient by their own local ID, and these are the pros and cons of the hash value, as we discussed earlier, if the hash values are shared and we have an algorithm that ensures that, you know, the same identifying traits result in an identical hash value no matter where it was calculated, then again, that information may allow multiple sites to know that they are looking at the same research participant. The other option, which is what health information exchanges are using today, is to correlate identities based on local information, local identifying information that is provided by each site. And these are the two options we outline here, and with the hope that they will lead to a fruitful discussion from our stakeholders. Next slide. So this is the first scenario, identification and re-identification. Actually, it's creating multi-site identifiers by using a set of identifying traits. So in this case, the coordinating center or the electronic record, electronic master patient index is for providing the identity coordination. So each site would register their research participants using an identity, a unique identifier that is local, and a set of identifying traits. This information is used by the coordinating center or an honest broker or another system that is available to the data sites and to the researcher to establish, for example, that this particular local identity has a multi-site identity. So that's the first determination that has to happen. Is this participant already known to us? And therefore, this data site A's identifier will be linked in to its known identity. If this participant has never been known before, then a new multi-site identity is created, and therefore any other subsequent identities will be linked to it. So what you're seeing here is the mechanism that most health information exchanges are using to correlate identities across accountable care organizations. So they maintain the knowledge that two identities are basically referring to a single participant. And that means that from that point on, any data sets that are exchanged by each one of these entities can use their local ad hoc identifier, you know, patient 123, patient 567, and the coordinating center or the master patient index has the ability to know that 123 and 567 are effectively the same individual. And that information is used for information sharing and retrieval. So when the researcher is saying, retrieve all the distinct records for this time range for my research participants, then the coordinating center is able to aggregate those records and provide a kind of an ad hoc multi-site research identifier to the researcher using the data. So yeah, and in this case, a certain amount of personally identifiable information is shared between each data site and this intermediary entity that provides the identity matching. Any questions? Any concerns about the sharing of identifiable information?
I think you said that HIEs are doing this now.
Yes.
And they're doing that because patients move around and we want data to follow the patient. Am I understanding this?
Exactly, yes. So a patient, not only do they move around, but they can also concurrently get care in more than one location. They may receive specialty care, inpatient care, ambulatory care in different places in the community. And a community HIE would have the ability to give the primary care provider a view of all the data that's been produced across the community. So the idea is that while the provider may know you by one identity, the health information exchange correlates all your identities across the system. And obviously different matching algorithms are used.
This is completely transparent to the patient has no idea this is happening. Is that true?
Well, the patient knows it's happening in the sense that they agree their information would be shared.
No idea it's being shared in this manner.
They know that it's shared. I'm not sure what you mean in this manner.
I mean
that there is no
across,
unique identity
across organizational boundaries.
They agree.
Yes, they agree. They agree that their information is shared across organizational boundaries, or else it will not if they don't agree to that. Yeah. Sorry.
When you join an HIE, you agree to have your information shared for treatment.
Right.
And there have been, you don't have to join an HIE, and there has been a lot of concern that those kinds of consents are not at all fine-grained. So it's typically opt-in or opt-out.
Exactly. So that it's an entirely opt-in, opt-out mechanism. But that refers to the actual data that is shared. So while there's sort of two separate issues. One is identity management and cross-referencing, and the other one is sharing information with specific granular restrictions in place. Most HIEs do not have that, but there are some HIEs, I just want to add, that are really willing and interested in adding more granular control to the patient, where they can express some preferences as to where some of their data may be shared, especially if it's protected data. But the patient identity cross-referencing in particular is a separate issue. It's kind of the enabling technology. The way you saw it in use case number one, we were referring to the fact that there is a multi-site research identifier out there to enable the sharing of information. And that's really what this is. So the individuals will either opt in to the sharing of their clinical information or not. The patient identity cross-referencing is kind of an element of infrastructure that is set up by each HIE. So this is, again, in this scenario, some identifiable information is shared for the purposes of identity cross-referencing. The other scenario, the one Daniela discussed earlier, assumes that the sites, so if we go to 4B, the sites will not share any patient any identifiable information, but they will rely on a common hash function to create these identities based on these identifiers based on patient identifying traits, such that patient John Smith is going to have the same hash value produced by each site, and therefore that's where the coordination will come in. Again, there are some drawbacks with this approach as well, because not only not only the scenario that Kevin was describing, that now if you have data for this patient, you know, you can, you know, and you're also doing research, you actually have effectively potentially re-identify this patient. And again, this is where also the legal framework has to be in place to establish some responsibilities for situations where that re-identification is within the reach of the researcher. And the other item is obviously the approach that is used to create the hash. It may also have other technical shortcomings, so those have to be addressed. But in the same way, the multi-site identity is maintained by either the researcher or a centralized system. In this case, I think there's more flexibility, since each site is producing the multi-site identifier for the patient.
So I guess I'm not clear why we are hearing about this. It's just fascinating to discover how treatment across boundaries can be facilitated by technology that matches John Smith at A to John Smith at B. But this is all within the treatment permission under HIPAA. Research is different, isn't it? So how does this map to a researcher being the endpoint of this whole process? Are you suggesting that it's the same, or you're just suggesting that identification, de-identification, rematching, and so forth is technically possible?
What I'm saying is re-identification is technically possible in the scenario that Kevin outlined, where you know where hash value is used as an identifier. Yes, you could, if you are treating this patient, compute that hash value based on all your known patient records and match them up.
Mm-hmm.
But the hash value is unidirectional. You can go from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and reverse engineer, you know, John Smith. That's not possible. So that is sort of the built-in assumption of the hash value. It's a one-way street as far as encoding. The other thing that you would, you know, in order for you to re-identify this patient, you would have to actually go a little bit out of your way to do this. So while sharing of patient identifiable information may be, you know, not something that researchers can do for the purposes of creating a multi-site identifier, I think where Daniela was going was that perhaps creating a hash value identifier for each participant is actually more feasible for the reasons you're describing. The treatment and research are different, and there are higher bars to overcome in protecting the privacy of research participants. So this a secondary approach would allow basically either a coordinating center or the researcher themselves to be able to manage identities across sites, because the sites themselves are effectively creating the multi-site identifier that would be used. So this would be an approach that perhaps would be more amenable, and from discussions we had earlier with the legal team, that this may be actually the way of the future in providing multi-site identifiers. And it also relieves the researcher from a dependency on a coordinating center. So this particular function could be fulfilled by a coordinating center or by a researcher's own information system, because the multi-site identifiers are produced at the source of the data. Any questions? And we have 5 more minutes, so Priscilla, how would you like to proceed?
Yeah,
we can revisit use case number one, or we can...
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering, so I don't know, Joanna, you think you can sort of maybe orient folks again to use case one? I feel like we
sure.
need to do a more detailed elaboration maybe when we meet with them next week, but maybe you want to just bring it up a little bit, you know?
Sure, yeah. So, again, the reason why we need multi-site identifiers, because starting with use case one, we have had several scenarios that required information from multiple sites, from multiple sources to be combined to support a research study. Therefore, let's go to the next slide. Therefore, we assume some things are already in place. We assume some sort of information exchange, standard-based information exchange between all the information systems involved is available. We also assume there was some sort of coordinating center that enables the exchange of information between the researcher and all the possible data sites where the information resides. And this could include covered entities, health departments, vital statistics offices, and so on. So we have had an assumption all along that our researchers would require access to information from multiple sites, and therefore a complex set of data use agreements, identifying research participants, protocol guidance from the IRB was also assumed to be in place. One element that was called out explicitly as a very valuable use case for analysis and refinement was this requirement for a multi-site identifier that can match a participant across sites. So in order to have accurate results, we need to make sure that we're looking, that if we're looking at the same individual across sites, that we have a way of cross-referencing that identity. And again, the discussion about how you accomplish that while at the same time protecting the privacy of research participants is precisely what we want to quantify so we can reference the issues to CLIN 2 and have them elaborate an optimal framework to address those requirements. And again, just revisiting this gives you a sense that while we're carving out these units of work and these goals, there are a lot of other things that have to be in place from an infrastructure and also from an interoperability standpoint that need to be there as enabling technologies and components. So I think it was probably as much as we will have time to cover today. We have some more minutes, according to Mike.
I think so for the next call, you know, we have a specific scenario on combining birth records with claims data, and then I think we should revisit use case one. And I guess just for all of our participants, we are actually meeting with you again next week, so we can sort of pick up on this discussion, you know, at our next meeting. So I think with that, I want to say thank you to everyone, and I guess we'll be talking to at least some subset of you on, you know, at 1 o'clock next Wednesday, okay? Thanks, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference.
Thank you.
We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.